Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. First off, it's Friday, everyone, so welcome. It was an interesting test this week for the Biden administration's promise of a so-called values-based foreign policy. Secretary of State Antony Blinken gave his first big speech on how the United States under President Biden will engage with rivals and allies.
At our best, the United States is a country with integrity and a heart. That's what makes us proud to be Americans. The Biden administration's foreign policy will reflect our values. We will stand firm behind our commitments to human rights, democracy, the rule of law.
Blinken talked about China, about Russia. He talked about climate change. But one nation he didn't name check? Saudi Arabia. The Secretary of State's silence is rather curious, given that this week President Biden announced a new policy towards that key Middle East ally.
I spoke yesterday with the king, not the prince. Made it clear to him that the rules are changing.
Not the prince. Well, last week, the Biden administration released a declassified intelligence report that blamed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Some sanctions followed, but it was hardly the make him pay rebuke that Biden had promised during his presidential campaign. So when the president says the rules are changing, are they really? Some want a rupture in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Biden wants recalibration. So today, we're going to look at the U.S.'s alliance with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, real politics in the Middle East, and what a so-called values-based foreign policy means and its limits. And we'll begin today with Dr. Khaled Al-Jabri. His father, Saad, was a former senior Saudi intelligence official who fled the country because the Crown Prince has reportedly ordered his execution. Dr. Al-Jabri, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
So first of all, can you just tell us a little bit of the story about your father and what happened to him and why he had to flee Saudi Arabia?
My father, Dr. Saad, used to be a very senior official in the Saudi government. He was actually appointed as a cabinet minister by King Salman himself in January 2015. But his main job before that for 15 years was to be the main interlocutor between Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and the Five Eyes nations when it comes to cooperation on counterterrorism efforts. He developed a very close relationship with both the Bush administration and the Obama-Biden administration, including a lot of the returning officials in this administration. More importantly, he was the right-hand man of the previous Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, who is D.C.'s most trusted Saudi royal, prior to 2017. And that's where things got complicated for my father and my family. We were basically caught in the middle of a power struggle between two royals. Dad saw the warning signs early, and he left the kingdom in May 2017. Unfortunately, two of my siblings, who were minor then, were held in Saudi as hostages, and they've been detained since.
They've been detained?
Yes.
Okay. So you currently have family members in detention. Now, regarding your father, just to be clear, I mean, when you said things got complicated, the Crown Prince has reportedly, as I said earlier, ordered his execution?
It's been a nonstop intimidation campaign since the first day as MBS became Crown Prince. His first order of business was banning my sister, Sarah, who was 17, from travel, and my brother, Omar, who was 18 at that time. The campaign continued through him issuing direct, documented threats and text messages, renditioning some of my family members from outside Saudi, and eventually sending a hit squad to Canada where Dad was hiding.
Mm. Tell me more about that, because this is also, I mean, I mentioned the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. You're saying that an execution squad was sent to find your father?
So basically, yes. A couple of weeks after what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, there was a team composed of personnel that paralleled what happened in Istanbul in terms of expertise, intelligence, and a couple of forensic specialists who were basically apprehended at Ottawa Airport mid-October 2018. They were acting shady. They didn't give an explanation to, you know, why they were there. And I think the vigilance of the Canadian border authorities thwarted that attempt on my father's life. You know, it was probably MBS following through on his promise or on his, you know, documented threats to my father that he will use every mean to go after him, including things that were harmful. We didn't know what he meant by that because, you know, that threat was issued in September 2017, but a year later that came into full display. You know, we've basically, after the disappearance of my brother and sister, we had no choice but to seek redress in a U.S. federal court. And the details of that attempt on my father's life, including the ongoing campaign, are detailed in our lawsuits in Washington, D.C.
Are you concerned for your safety?
I am concerned for my safety, you know, and, you know, we've been taking a lot of precautionary measures. We're also under protection by the federal agencies in Canada as well. Everybody's keeping, you know, his eyes open. You know, what happened last week, although it was a welcome step towards transparency, I think the lack of direct accountability on MBS will actually render him more dangerous.
So let's talk more about that, because last week the Biden administration, as mentioned earlier, did release that previously classified, the declassified report that blamed Crown Prince Salman for ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That in and of itself is a significant step to point to the, you know, the extremely high-ranking member, the de facto essentially leader of a country, and say that person ordered the murder of an individual. Does it carry enough weight, Dr. Al-Jabri?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a significant step. I think the release of the Khashoggi report is, you know, welcomed and long-awaited, you know, transparency step. But so far, there has been no direct accountability in MBS. Not only is this far from President Biden's campaign pledge, but it will render MBS more dangerous, as I said. MBS will not understand the lack of accountability as some kind of conventional policy or realpolitik. He is less nuanced than people think he is. MBS will probably interpret the lack of accountability as a pass on murder. And unfortunately, he will continue to go after dissidents this time. He will see this as a near miss. And the learning curve is just to make sure that he doesn't get caught next time and he doesn't leave any fingerprints.
So tell us more about that, because, you know the royal family far better than I would say definitely me and most of the people listening. So tell me more about how you think Mohammed bin Salman is interpreting the Biden administration's moves over this past week.
So, you know, we've seen how MBS acted over the last 4 years, you know, given the blank check diplomacy that was given to him by the Trump administration. He thought he was, you know, he made the most out of it, thinking that it was, you know, a temporary blank check or, you know, a temporary kind of immunity or that allows him to act with impunity. He was really, you know, concerned about Biden's campaign pledge. He knew that the, you know, Democratic administration would be harsher on him. He feared direct sanctions and accountability. So the fact now that he managed to get a pass so far, he'll see it as, oh, even when in the context of somebody who has promised to keep me accountable, even in the context of a Democratic administration that wants to put human rights at the center of its foreign policy, I managed to get a pass. So whatever I do in the future, I will always get a pass.
So what then would, in your opinion, true accountability look like?
I think, you know, there are means to hold MBS accountable while maintaining a relationship. These are not mutually exclusive. You know, things can range from sanctioning his own personal assets, his entities, his organizations. Some of his organizations have been involved in espionage and surveillance. You know, I want to, you know, probably mentioned the MISC Foundation, you know, which is his child, and it's already implicated in recruiting spies that infiltrated Twitter and the subject of, you know, a criminal case in California. So there are more means to target MBS, the person, and not Saudi Arabia, the country. It's a fine line, and they have to thread it carefully, but I think there are still some more ways to hold MBS accountable.
Okay, so that's interesting because, of course, the United States has this long relationship with Saudi Arabia that Washington has historically seen as strategically, crucially important. So do you still believe that that fundamental sort of allyship, for lack of a better term, should continue between the two countries?
I think, you know, it's more of a partnership than an allyship. And I think despite being problematic, I think there are common areas of interest that need to continue. But like MBS or whoever leads Saudi Arabia needs to understand that a relationship with the U.S. is a two-way street. You can't behave like Iran or North Korea and expect it to be treated like a G20 country. You need to basically play by the rules. And, you know, President Biden has said that the rules have changed. So with that compliance to these kind of international human rights laws and norms, the relationship should not remain the way it was, especially over the past 4 years.
Mm. And what about your view of the future of Saudi Arabia itself, the nation itself, regardless of the relationship with Washington? Mm-hmm. What do you think about the future for the country?
I'm obviously concerned, and my concerns precede MBS, honestly. I think the current political, economic, social model is not sustainable. And without genuine reform, I think the future at best is very, vague and opaque. I have concerns about the over-reliance on oil. I have concerns about the young demographic and the rising unemployment rate. And without genuine reform, I think they're going to be very, very tough. What I'm seeing right now in Saudi, there are some kind of very selective, social liberalization efforts, but you can't reform a country and diversify its economy with piecemeal reform. It has to be collective. And any reform that does not include political reform and the establishment of institutions and, check and balances and oversight and accountability is 100% destined to fail.
Well, Dr. Khalid Al-Jabri is the son of a former senior Saudi intelligence official. His father is currently in hiding from an alleged or from execution orders from Mohammed bin Salman. His members of his family as well have been detained in Saudi Arabia. We'll talk more about the U.S.-Saudi relationship when we come back. Dr. Al-Jabri, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we are talking about rupture or recalibration of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And last week, before the Biden administration announced what it's calling a new policy towards Saudi Arabia, President Biden spoke with Univision. And Biden said the relationship between the two countries is changing.
I spoke yesterday with the king, not the prince, made it clear to him that the rules are changing. And we're going to be announcing significant changes today and on Monday. We are going to hold them accountable for human rights abuses. And we're going to make sure that they, in fact, and if they want to deal with us, they have to deal with it in a way where human rights abuses are dealt with.
Well, joining us now is Robin Wright, columnist for The New Yorker, contributor at the Wilson Center. Her piece this week on the Biden administration in Saudi Arabia is titled The Sweeping Impact of a Broken Biden Campaign Promise. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Robin, welcome.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
So first of all, give us your take on, you know, how about first of all, starting with what President Biden said there. He spoke yesterday. He spoke with the king, not the prince. Is this a meaningful shift in the United States approach to Saudi Arabia?
No, it's not. And given the fact that the president, as a candidate, had called Saudi Arabia a pariah with no redeeming social value and pledging to take punitive action, hold the kingdom accountable for the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi. The president's decision not to act against the crown prince and basically give him a pass was truly shocking. You know, Khashoggi was a friend of mine for over 30 years. And I think when you look at the way Biden had made human rights such a core issue in terms of defining his foreign policy, how he would be different from President Trump, how he would not be friends to the autocrats and dictators and monarchs in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Turkey or the Philippines, and for him basically to give the crown prince a pass on murder when it was so graphically documented by Turkish intelligence, including Khashoggi's last words as he gasped for breath as they were suffocating him, and then the bone saw 25 minutes later cutting up his body. It's just shocking that the United States did not do more.
Mm. Well, you mentioned the campaign promise that Biden made prior to the presidential election. Let's listen to that moment. This is during one of the debates late in election season, and Biden had been asked whether he, unlike then-President Trump, would punish Saudi leadership for Khashoggi's murder. And here's what Joe Biden said.
I would make it very clear. We were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. They have to be held accountable.
So, Robin Wright, what would pariah effectively be? Like, what could the United States do if Biden were to fulfill this specific promise?
Well, there are all kinds of options. What the Biden administration did was simply sanction the Rapid Intervention Force, what's known as the Tiger Squad, which carried out this murder, and the deputy head of General Intelligence, who was the mastermind. It also introduced a rule called the Khashoggi Rule, which will ban visas to anyone involved in state repression or detention or murder of opposition. But the only people who were prevented from getting visas are 76 Saudis, and the crown prince is never mentioned. There are simple things the administration could have done, such as impose a travel ban to make clear that the crown prince is not welcome in the United States. It would be a symbolic move because I think in some ways the crown prince knows he's not likely to be in Washington during the Biden administration, but it would spell out that he is a pariah. It would be a deep loss of face in a part of the world where image and face are very important. Another option would have been to seize the property of the crown prince and his immediate family. You know, there are a number of steps that would not have cost the United States very much, but it would have made the message much clearer that there is punishment for this. Of course, there are broader options. Because Khashoggi was a permanent resident of the United States. He worked for the Washington Post. We're not acting, taking action because against a Saudi who lived in Saudi Arabia and had no connection with the United States.
Mm. Well, so, you know, to your point about the lack of direct implications for Mohammed bin Salman, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has recently said that, you know, in the administration's view, that, quote, we have to understand that this is bigger than any one person, that the relationship with Saudi Arabia is bigger than any one individual. And he was asked about that as well on PBS's NewsHour on Wednesday of this week. And Secretary Blinken said that foreign policy essentially means addressing the world as you find it. And here's what he said.
We deal, unfortunately, every single day with leaders of countries who are responsible for actions we find either objectionable or abhorrent, whether it's Vladimir Putin, whether it's Xi Jinping, whether it's any others on a long list of people I could name. But we find ways to deal with them. And the question I think we have to ask ourselves is, in terms of advancing not just our interests, but our values, are we better off rupturing the relationship with Saudi Arabia or recalibrating it? In terms of ending the war in Yemen, are we better off having recalibrated the relationship or rupturing it?
So, Robin Wright, there's a couple of different parts there that I'd like to investigate with you. First of all, Blinken pointing out that there are many distasteful leaders out there that the United States, in his words, has to deal with. And he doesn't, he's essentially saying that Mohammed bin Salman is no different than that. And therefore, I suppose, justifying the lack of direct sanctions against bin Salman. Your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, he shouldn't have made those claims during the campaign and then turned around and done something very different as president. A lot of politicians do that, but human rights was such a central plank in his platform that he looks like a terrible hypocrite. And at the beginning of his administration, this will be seen as a signal to not just the Saudis, but to autocrats around the world that they can do what they please, that the United States, if they're important enough strategically, the leaders of those countries can get away with things like murder and detention. This is a decision that was made largely because of the calculation that the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is likely to be the leader of Saudi Arabia for the next 30, 40, even 50 years. He's only 35. And he has basically carved out a whole new royal family from the thousands of princes who are the descendants of the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, King Ibn Saud. And he skipped over many of his brothers. He's consolidated the hold on all five channels to power. He's Minister of Defense. He's head of the Economic Council. He has the keys to the royal court. No one can see the king unless they get clearance from him. He controls the clergy and he controls the interior ministry. So there are very few mechanisms now for the kind of consensus that has ruled Saudi Arabia. In the past, all the brothers and cousins and sons had some kind of role. They ruled by consensus and input from all of them. Now it's a pure dictatorship. And the Biden administration has decided that in those circumstances, it has to deal with a dictator.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit later more about that bigger picture of rupture versus recalibration vis-a-vis U.S.-Saudi relations in a second. And I'm going to dive into more details about Mohammed bin Salman himself. But there is still one more thing about that Blinken cut that we played, Robin, that I'd love to hear you respond to. Essentially, Anthony Blinken is there. The Secretary of State is talking about, you campaign in poetry, but you have to govern in prose. I mean, it's a terrible cliche, but in the world of foreign policy, I think the United States, for decades has shown that it talks a high talk about human rights, but then when administration comes into power, it simply picks off where the last one left off. I mean, Xi Jinping in China, essentially practicing a form of ethnic cleansing against the Uyghurs there, but the United States still sort of lumbers along in its tension-filled relations with China because we don't want to rupture it. It's too important. I mean, I think we could point to any other number of examples. Is not the Biden administration's current mode regarding Saudi then simply to be expected regardless of what he said on the campaign trail?
Maybe it's to be expected, but he looks like a terrible hypocrite. And frankly, his policy is not that much different from President Trump's.
Right. And so therefore, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is not a particular form of hypocrisy fundamental to U.S. foreign policy?
Well, unfortunately, it is. It has been in the past. There are a lot of presidents who talked about human rights and did very little. President Trump was probably the least interested in human rights. So Biden giving it attention, at least in his rhetoric, signaled some kind of hope that, you know, in the 21st century, as the wave of democracy has, spread around the world and then faced real challenges, that he was going to stand up for American values. And I think there are a lot of people around the world who are wondering again, what are American values and is America going to stand up for what it believes in.
Yeah. And so just to be clear, I am not justifying that fundamental hypocrisy under any circumstances, but I am curious in exploring what allows it to persist. So that's one of my goals here for this hour, especially regarding Saudi Arabia. So, Robin, hang on for just a second, because I'd like to bring into the conversation now Bernard Haykel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times, spoken with him as well, and currently writing a book about the Saudi royal family. Professor Haykel, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Robin Wright made a very crucial point a couple of minutes ago about the fact that Mohammed bin Salman is going to be on the scene, at the top of the scene in Saudi Arabia, for decades into the future. So it is important to really understand him as well as we possibly can. So what do you think we ought to know about the Crown Prince that'll help us understand the dynamics of the current situation between the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia?
I mean, I think Robin is right that he is likely to be the king for a very long time, and that he sees certain structural challenges facing the kingdom. It's a view that's shared by other princes, namely that oil eventually will either run out or become much less profitable, that there's a huge demographic bulge with lots of young people. You have a religious kind of reactionary scene that has not allowed the country to socially liberalize, and that he wants to address all of these issues in order to maintain regime survival. I think his first and foremost concern, as it is for almost any autocrat in the Middle East, is regime survival. And that is what he's trying to accomplish. And he's adopted populist, nationalist policies, and of course has consolidated power and has become very repressive. Now, where I disagree with Robin on one point is that everything he has, every power he has, was given to him by his father, who's an absolute monarch. So it's not like he somehow got this power illegally, according to Saudi Arabia. It's his father who gave it to him.
So let me take a step back here, because I want to emphasize that you've met with him in person, right? At least
yes.
Several times. What is he like?
I mean, he's a very charismatic, he's a very big guy, tall, very charismatic, inundates his interlocutor with facts and figures, seems to be on top of lots and lots of data, makes you feel like you're the center of the universe, a bit like Bill Clinton had that, ability. And lots of people who've met him, lots of Americans have been very impressed with him as a politician. As a kind of charismatic politician.
Huh. And when, do you mind if I ask the dates that when you met with him in person?
Well, I haven't met him since COVID, but I mean, I have met with him in 2015, 16 and 17 and then 18, I think. And then I also, exchanged WhatsApp messages with him as he does with many other Americans.
And so then, regarding the fact that the United States has publicly released this report that explicitly says that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, I mean, what are your thoughts on that regarding this person that you met?
Well, it's an assessment, right?
So okay.
It's an assessment. The report doesn't actually have what one would call a smoking gun, meaning like here's a communication we intercepted where he gave the order. So it's an assessment. Just like the CIA assessed a bunch of other things before, including whether Iraq had nuclear weapons or not. And I would have liked to have seen a smoking gun. Mm.
Robin Wright, would you like to respond?
Sure. I think that no one ever expected the assessment to detail classified intelligence. It was always known this was just going to be the bottom line, which concluded that the Crown Prince approved of the of the murder and the operation, sent the hit squad. But no details are likely ever to come out. After all, remember, we've heard the tape that was done by Turkish intelligence that very graphically illustrated and, gave us the sense of what his last moments were like. The fact is that his body is still missing. The you know, the whole idea that he's not culpable for this is ludicrous. There are few times in the world that you can associate a head of state so particularly, so specifically with such evidence as you can in the case of Mohammed bin Salman's role in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Professor Haykel, your response?
I mean, I don't disagree that, you know, it's very possible that he was involved. It's also possible that one of his lieutenants was trying to show off and you know, gift him with like a big victory and took it upon himself to do this. And I know that, for instance, the head of Saudi intelligence was not involved in this operation. A lot of their the adults in the system were not involved in the operation. So there's something really strange about the way in which it was conducted.
We will get back to this, the sort of umbrella issue of U.S.-Saudi relations in a moment. But I just have to ask, Professor Haykel, I'm curious, since you've had also exchanged WhatsApp messages with the Crown Prince, have you asked him if he ordered the killing of Khashoggi?
Yes, I have asked him, and he's denied it. And he's also said that this was a rogue operation. And it took him a month for him to admit to that.
Okay, well, we have to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about, in a sense, the tip of the iceberg, what this means about the bigger issue of the future of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Again, some are calling for a rupture. The Biden administration is seeking a recalibration. But what does that mean? We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are exploring the United States relationship with Saudi Arabia. Some folks want a rupture, to put it that way. Others, specifically the Biden administration itself, is seeking a recalibration of that relationship. But what would that look like, given the realities of the strategic importance of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East? I'm joined today by Robin Wright. She's columnist for The New Yorker, contributor at the Wilson Center. Her piece this week on the Biden administration in Saudi Arabia is titled The Sweeping Impact of a Broken Biden Campaign Promise. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Bernard Haykel also joins us, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, currently writing a book about the Saudi royal family. And we spoke with Sarah Leah Whitson as well, a friend of Jamal Khashoggi. She now heads the organization Khashoggi founded called Dawn, or Democracy for the Arab World Now. And here's what she told us.
The Biden administration's announcement was very disappointing, but not really shocking, because President Biden himself made very specific promises about holding Mohammed bin Salman accountable for the murder of Khashoggi. But it's also clear that the Biden administration has, from the onset, been speaking out of both sides of its mouth.
And she provided us an example. She looks at the administration's announcement that it will block the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia that would be used in the war in Yemen, but will still deliver defensive weapons to the country. Now, here's a completely different view about the importance of how the United States handles Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, and his involvement in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Michael Doran, an expert in Middle East security at the Hudson Institute, says this.
The killing of Khashoggi was brutal and absolutely indefensible. But the vital interests of the United States and the Middle East are bound up in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And it would be extremely unwise to permanently damage the U.S.-Saudi relationship because of this one killing.
So Robin Wright, the Biden administration is talking a lot about a values-based foreign policy. But will U.S. interests continue to win out, as Michael Doran says?
I suspect that will be the prevailing platform, you know, when it comes to actually doing things with other heads of state. But the question really coming out of the Khashoggi murder is Saudi Arabia really an important ally, or how important is it? The Crown Prince has engaged not only in the murder of a dissident, attempted murder of others, but he's also engaged in war in Yemen, that is Saudi Arabia's Vietnam, and has produced the worst humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world. He ordered the Prime Minister of Lebanon to go to Riyadh a few years ago and forced him on Saudi television to resign. He has tried to exert his power, not just inside the kingdom, but across the region. And so, you know, the question becomes, is this the place the U.S. wants to invest its power, particularly at a time the United States is increasingly energy independent? Mm-hmm. Now, allies clearly will depend on Gulf oil. Saudi Arabia has value for that. But as climate change becomes an issue, as alternative energy sources are explored and developed, Saudi Arabia's value may go down. And the question is, do we really want to support and arm and protect a man or a regime that is engaged in this kind of brutality? And remember that for all Saudi wealth, the kingdom has many of its own domestic problems. Roughly a third of the young are unemployed. His plans for diversification in the future, something called Vision 2030, involves some kind of wild ambitions to create whole new cities, some of them manned by robots, there's a dreamer and an unrealistic side to him that I'm not sure this kingdom is long term the most stable place.
So Professor Haykel, Robin Wright is raising what I think is the core question here, which is, what now is the United States getting out, or should be seeking to get out, of its relationship with Saudi Arabia? Because just to reiterate, I mean, for what we could say roughly a century, much of that relationship has been based on oil. Less of an issue for the United States now, but per Robin's observation, still perhaps a important issue for other U.S. allies. But then beyond that, there's the catastrophe in Yemen. I wonder, beyond essentially fighting a proxy war with Iran, what is the United States, that the Saudi is doing that, what is the United States getting out of its relationship with Riyadh?
So, the fundamental U.S. strategic interest in the region is stability. And that is something that the U.S. has not been good at doing. The region cannot be stable if you don't have a relationship with Saudi Arabia and a strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. The argument that we're energy independent is a bit of a red herring, because oil is a global and fungible commodity. Saudi reserves are the cheapest and easiest to produce in the world. They will forever be important for us and for many other countries, even if we don't import any oil from there. And Saudi Arabia is crucial for building and normalizing a relationship with Israel. It's important for the Muslim world, since it's at the center of the Muslim world. It is important for stopping and also rebuilding Yemen. A war, by the way, that both the Obama and the Trump administrations have been involved in and have supported Saudi Arabia in. I also think, actually, fundamentally, though, that, and just going back to an earlier point, that Biden is not like Trump at all. Because I think that what President Biden will do is build a relationship with Saudi Arabia that is based on institutions, and based on, you know, rather than transactional, personal, WhatsApp-based connections and relations, it'll be based on core interests, core, you know, institutional relations. And that will change the way Saudi Arabia behaves. And I think it's a very good thing for both the United States and for Saudi Arabia that President Biden is doing what he's doing.
So talk to me a little bit more about that. When you say institutions, specifically what or how? Do you have an example in mind?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the past, for instance, the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia was often based on a close relationship between, let's say, the energy ministry or the petroleum ministry of the United States and our energy ministry, the foreign affairs State Department and their foreign affairs intelligence was extremely important, and it was a very powerful relationship and effective one in the war against jihadists and Al Qaeda and ISIS. Those relationships were ruptured and or at least weakened and attenuated by President Trump, who essentially was very transactional with the Saudis, with the exception of the issue of Iran. It was one where Trump often humiliated the Saudis publicly in what he said. That was not good for the U.S. and it was not good for Saudi Arabia. I think you have adults, you have adults now in the room. You have people who understand core U.S. strategic interests, and that is what the relationship will be based on. And I think that's a good thing.
Okay, so Robin Wright, a couple questions for you then. Do you think that to my ear, it sounds like Bernard Haykel is describing kind of a perhaps a more effective slow diplomacy through the workings of various institutions. Could that produce not just an improved relationship, but an improved outcome for the United States regarding its posture towards Saudi Arabia?
Well, the relationship has always been, whether it's energy ministries, the intelligence ministries, there's always been that institutional relationship, and that will probably continue. The question is, how much do you invest in the people in power? Do you give them a pass? Do you embrace them? And the message is that the United States is willing to do that. And As I said, I think this is, you know, in the 21st century, you know, we're trying to change the ways of the world of the 20th. And this basically says we're going to perpetuate alliances with the bad boys. Bernie says that the MBS is powerful because his father gave him those powers. Well, the crown prince is quite a manipulator. And, in the same way he got his father to bypass all of the other royals in the line of succession, he wrested control of these channels of power from a man who is in his mid-80s and believed to be ailing. The crown prince is trying to ensure that there are no challenges to him from other members of the royal family who he has alienated. And one of the things that's concerning about the kingdom is the alienation of whole sectors of the royal family, including the family of the former crown prince, who Mohammed bin Salman bumped aside, including the family of the former king. There's no more consensus in the kingdom, and I don't think that bodes well for its future.
Right. So, Robin, fact check me on something. Have we seen any other nation, any European nation, Canada, what have you, punish Saudi Arabia more directly or than what the Biden administration did?
I don't think so. The United Nations came out with its own investigation not long after the murder, and it concluded that MBS played, you know, the pivotal role as well. And the world hasn't done very much, but many of countries in the West look to the United States for leadership and hoping that solidarity and joint action will have a much more much bigger effect. And in this case, the United States, you know, is leading the West and saying, we don't care.
Interesting. Because Bernard Haykel, let me get your response to that, because it does seem that, like, if no one's doing anything, what does that mean?
Right. So, you know, when I listen to Robin, what I hear is a liberal interventionist, in other words, gunboat diplomacy with silk gloves, interfering in the inner workings of the Saudi royal family, how they decide on their on the issues of succession, whether the regime should or shouldn't remain in power. I mean, those are things that, you know, neocons tried to do in the Middle East with the Iraq War. This time it's liberals who are trying to do kind of effect regime change. And I think the U.S. should not be in the business of regime change. We should not interfere in other people's internal workings. Those are for the Saudis to decide and work out, whether it's through an absolutist monarchy or democracy or whatever they decide to choose. We have interests in this region, and those are our priorities. And I don't think we should in any way interfere, as I said, in the domestic affairs of other countries.
Robin, go ahead and respond.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie, please don't insult me and please don't put words in my mouth. I'm not supporting regime change at all. I'm saying in terms of U.S. interests, what is the good strategic bet? And is this the country you want to see as your close ally? Yeah, so if they continue institutional relationships, fine. And we're talking about, you know, the standing of one man, not the whole kingdom. I was trying to put the crown prince in context of the changes in whether it's the world energy market or broader political trends. I do not support regime change. The United States, I deeply thought the United States made a classic mistake going into Iraq. I'm talking about what are in U.S. interests long term, and are human rights important to the United States? And on that, I think human rights, you know, as a descendant of a signer of the Declaration of Independence, I believe very much in human rights. And I, you know, I think labeling each other is a disservice to listeners.
Well, so we've only got about 2 minutes left here, and I apologize for how little time we have remaining. But I want to just refocus for 1 second as a final question to both of you on where the Biden administration finds itself regarding foreign policy writ large. Because during the campaign, Joe Biden definitely said he was going to move away from America first, values-based foreign policy, et cetera. So here ostensibly was a moment where the world could observe what that meant concretely, right, in terms of here is America's new approach to foreign policy. And yet, by not acting perhaps as forcefully or directly as Robin has been talking about, is it a missed opportunity to recalibrate the U.S. in the eyes of the global community? Professor Haeckel, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't mean to label. I would label myself as a pragmatic realist. And I know that Prince Mohammed bin Salman controls all the military forces in the country. And if we were to try to destabilize his succession, he would make sure that something really bad happens in that country. And I don't want to see that happen. I grew up in the Lebanese Civil War. In fact, the first time I ever met Robin was in Lebanon when I was a teenager. And I would not want to see what happened to Lebanon happen to Saudi Arabia. And I think we have to be very careful in deciding how we push our foreign policy agenda. Human rights are extremely important, but as are fundamental strategic interests.
Robin Wright, we've got about 30 or 40 seconds left, but go ahead.
Yes, Biden missed a real opportunity to stake a claim on the human rights issue. And the whole idea of punishing one man, whether it's a simple action like preventing him from coming to the United States or freezing some of his assets, that's not going to lead to a civil war in Saudi Arabia. It's taking a stand on a man who engaged in an atrocious murder.
Well, Robin Wright is a columnist for The New Yorker, contributor at the Wilson Center. Her latest piece is titled "The Sweeping Impact of a Broken Biden Campaign Promise." Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bernard Haeckel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, folks, on Monday, we are going to be talking about the Biden administration's embrace of equity and the difference between equity and equality, if there is a difference. For example, here is Vice President Kamala Harris talking about that distinction late last month.
We have always fought for equality, but now we are also talking much more rightly about equity, understanding that we must be clear-eyed about the fact that, yes, we want everyone to get an equal amount, that sounds right. But not everyone starts out from the same place.
The vice president also said if the goal is truly about equality, it has to be about a goal that everyone should end up in the same place. So what do you think about that, equality and equity? Your thoughts? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's for Monday's show. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.